Anybody here related to anyone famous? Anybody? I know you are, Liz, other than me. Liz raised her hand. So, I mean, I know she was talking about me. You know, Tim Sheff, she's related to Tim. You're related to somebody famous?
Robert Louis Stevenson.
Okay, looky there. Nice. Anybody else? You know, I remember growing up, I think one of my uncles did like a genealogy of the Clark slash Gamble, which was my mother's maiden name, down through history. And if I remember right, I talked to my mother yesterday, I should have confirmed this. Like, we go back to, you know, England and UK and all that, and I think in my history is like William and Mary of Orange. Have you guys heard of them? I think. You know, my mother will listen to this and she'll probably call or text me and be like, you have made up a story. And so if it is, I'll fix that in the coming weeks. But I realize that I'm often mistaken for the dad of a famous Clark, but unfortunately there is no relation and unfortunately no financial benefit coming this way. So there is some fascination with knowing where we come from, isn't there? I mean, in fact, there's even been a few TV shows that have become, you know, popular over the years. Like, there's one that was called Finding Your Roots. Anybody ever watch that one? Or there was one called Who Do You Think You Are? And they would trace the history and they would kind of look and see, who are you related to? What's in your past? You know, and there was often reveals of, you know, shocking or scandalous facts from our lineage. No, this is not the Mari, you are not the father kind of stuff. But, you know, occasionally they would have a parent or a grandparent that might not have been as biological as you thought, or an ancestor with a sordid past, or even a career criminal, or even like this one kind of scandalous thing that happened in one of these shows where you discovered that your family were slave owners. In fact, that's what happened to actor Ben Affleck. I don't know if you guys knew this. So about a decade ago, there was an incident that blew up because as they went through his history, he actually asked them to not reveal what they had discovered. And as you can imagine, that was kind of a cover-up and a scandal. But can you blame him? I mean, they discovered his ancestors were slave owners, and it's like, I don't know that I would want that information coming out. I mean, do any of us really like to have our dirty laundry aired on social media or anywhere else? Of course not. We try to keep those things hidden. Nobody wants all the world to know our dirty little secrets, except for the Bible. Have you noticed that? I mean, there's something about the Bible where the Bible really doesn't mind just putting it all out there for us to see and for all those sordid little details to just be laid out there in front of us. And I mean, if you think about it, it's kind of interesting that the Bible does that, because if you were putting together a religion and you thought, I want to create a religion that people want to be a part of, something aspirational, what are we going to put in that book? I think we're going to put the good stories, right? We're only going to put the success stories. We're not going to put the difficulties, the challenges, or anything that's going to make somebody look bad. And yet right there in black and white for us, for all the world to see, is all the difficulty, all the doubt, the sexual impropriety, the murder, the lying, the treachery. I mean, you name it, you can probably find it in the Bible. Now, I can read your thoughts already, and you're like, Brent, it's Advent season. You're supposed to be getting us ready for Christmas. When are we going to start decking the halls and such? Don't worry, we'll get there. But this Advent season, what we want to do is we want to take a look at the genealogy of Jesus. Who is in his family line? And more specifically, the women that are included. There are five women mentioned in Matthew's genealogy of Jesus. And we're going to look at them. We're calling this hidden figures, because if you're not paying attention, you can just read right past them. And they're there, and we want to kind of say, why are they there? What can we learn about them? Why were the writers of the New Testament so intentional about making sure that their names were included? And we have to acknowledge that, at least for Bible times, this is kind of an interesting thing to do. Now, it's not unheard of. Women could be listed in a genealogy, but for the most part, it was all about the man. What man fathered what man, as if women weren't part of that process at all. But we know they were. And the women that were listed, I think it would be wise for us to say, why? What is their story? But I do need to give you a word of warning. These are not your normal, lovely, sanitized stories of the Bible. They are messy. You may squirm a little bit today. Good. There are some graphic details. I mean, these stories might be banned in some libraries, just so you know. They are at least PG-13, and depending on the director, they could be rated R. I mean, these stories that we're going to hear, most likely you have never seen on a VeggieTale. I mean, I'm just saying, okay? So who's ready to dive in now that I've set this up so good, right? So to start, we just want to turn to Matthew chapter 1. Who are we going to be looking at? And just to set this up a little bit, in the New Testament, Luke and Matthew both list genealogies of Jesus. And if you start looking at them, you might wonder, what's the deal? Because they don't line up. They aren't identical, which some people find problematic. But this doesn't have to be. I mean, some scholars say that Matthew gives Jesus' line through his father Joseph, while Luke goes through the mother Mary. Others say their emphasis is different because they have different purposes. And to be honest, we may not fully be able to resolve this. We have to live with a little bit of tension here. It's okay, right? We have to remember that 2,000 years ago when people wrote, they didn't write with a 21st century mentality. They weren't writing a history book. They weren't writing to get everything exactly right. In fact, in some levels, you'll see, oh, there were 14 generations between here and here. And if you start looking, it's like, there were a little bit more than 14 or maybe less than 14. It just happened to work. That's what they said. And that's okay. That's what they did at the time. We don't put our standards on what they did then. And we understand this, okay? So we may not be able to resolve it, but what we do know is that Matthew, the way he wrote, is he was choosing to emphasize something very specific about Jesus. And that was his kingship, that he came through the line of King David, and that Jesus is king. So we're going to keep that in mind as we read this these next few weeks. But let's just start with Matthew chapter 1, and here's what we read. It says, "This is the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Perez, the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram." We're just going to stop there because we've already hit the first woman in the book. Three verses in, and we see she's listed as the mother of Perez and Zerah, but not much else. And so if you're like me, you kind of want to know, well, who is this woman and what do we want to know about her? Well, to get her story, we turn back to Genesis chapter 38. Now, if you were with us in February of 24, now I realize that was almost 2 years ago. You might remember we did a series on the life of Joseph. Anybody remember that? Yep. Now what you may, if you were astute and you were watching as we were going, we did 6 weeks in that and we did about a chapter a week, except there was a week we skipped a chapter. This is the chapter that we skipped, was Genesis chapter 38, because it really didn't have to do with the life of Joseph. It's kind of a carve-out where we pause for a moment in the story of Joseph and we talk about one of his brothers, Judah. And it's in Genesis 38 that we get this wild, crazy story about Judah and this woman named Tamar. And as I said before, that you're going to find this is going to be incredibly messy, and there's going to be disturbing details of a woman who's living as a victim of a patriarchal system, and while having no power herself, she does have agency, and she uses her agency to force the right thing to be done. And by doing so, she becomes a vehicle for God's redemption for the world. So let's look and see what we read about Tamar. Genesis 38, it says this. It says, "At that time, Judah left his brothers and went down to stay with a man of Adullam named Hirah. There Judah met the daughter of a Canaanite man named Shua. He married her, made love to her. She became pregnant and gave birth to a son who was named Ur. She conceived again and gave birth to a son named Onan. She gave birth to still another son named Shelah. And it was at Kezib that she gave birth to him." Now here we're introduced again to this guy named Judah. Judah was the fourth-born son of Jacob. He was the brother of Joseph. Remember, there were 12 sons. Joseph was not the youngest, but he was the favorite. Had the coat of many colors, all that fun stuff. And Judah was the brother, if you remember, when the brothers were like, "We got to kill him," Judah was the one that spoke up and said, let's don't kill him. Let's just sell him as a slave. What do you think? And so that's what they did. And here we read that Judah, after this has gone on with Joseph, he's left home, he's gotten married, and now he's got three sons of his own. Let's keep reading. It says, Judah got a wife for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. So here we go. Here's Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death. Uh-oh. Things are not going well. We start to see some problems unfolding. We're introduced to her. She marries this guy. We don't know what wicked thing he did. The Bible doesn't tell us. We just know that whatever he did wasn't great and he died. Now, this could have simply meant that he died young. Because think about the system that they were in the ancient Near East. For a young man to die, you would probably automatically think, God's not happy with him. So this man dies young. God must have allowed it. And in this system where women had little value, except to produce a male heir, this could have been a problem for Tamar. But there were laws, there were customs in place to help protect women like Tamar. And so there was this custom that says she should be taken care of. Let's keep reading and we'll see what this custom is. It says, then Judah, you know, he's lost one son. He says to his second son, Onan, he says, sleep with your brother's wife. Now I realize right now, 21st century thinking, we're like, now that's just, we've crossed a line. This is part of the custom. Sleep with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty to her as a brother-in-law to raise up offspring for your brother. But Onan knew that the child would not be his. So whenever he slept with his brother's wife, he spilled his semen on the ground to keep from providing offspring for his brother. Probably the first time I've said semen in a sermon in 18 years, just for the record. What he did was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death also. Merry Christmas. What a great Christmas story, right? Don't you love this Christmas story? Best Christmas sermon ever. Best one. But this was the custom. If a woman's husband died and she was childless, basically she had no one to care for her. A couple of things could happen. The levirate custom was for the brother of the widow, the guy that died, to marry. Now, the father-in-law could also release the woman to go and get remarried to somebody else or just send them home to be with their dad and live as a widow forever. But then you're kind of left with, what do you do? You know, if you're released to get remarried, you got to find somebody that wants to marry a widow. Or if you go back home, you're only as safe until your father dies, and then you're going to be at the mercy of the system and the culture and everything else. So this levirate marriage custom, as it was called, said if a man dies and his wife doesn't have a child because the male heir would be the one to care for her, then the brother needs to step in. The brother needs to sleep with her until she gets pregnant so that when she has a child, a male heir, that male heir will take the place of the brother that has died. That was the way it worked. This heir would be considered the heir of the dead husband, not the one who sired him, if that makes sense. The problem is this. It wasn't just that the son was the son of the dead guy. It also meant that everything that the firstborn that is dead would have gotten now goes to their son. You see a problem here? You see what the secondborn son is asked to do? They're asked to put somebody ahead of them in the birthright order, and thereby doing so, take less. It's a problem, right? Onan, produce an heir. Put yourself in second place. And as we see here in the story, Onan says, I don't think so. Now, publicly, from everything we know, outwardly, he looks like a good guy. It looks like he's doing the right thing. He marries his brother's widow. It appears everything is going well. But in one of the more intimate verses of the Bible, we see he's actually not doing everything right. What he was doing was he was repeatedly satisfying his own sexual desires. See, there's no confusion here. So when we read that whenever he slept with her, That's not like it happened once. This happened repeatedly. This was a persistent practice over and over. And so Tamar basically becomes the victim of a system that requires her to just lay there while she is repeatedly sexually assaulted because he's not fulfilling his obligation. So she could do nothing. She was powerless. But we see that God knew the wickedness and the evil that was taking place, and he did something about it. And like his brother, Onan dies. Now, think about this. Two brothers gone. You've got this widow now, twice over. How do you think Judah is going to feel about this woman? What's interesting is you think he might feel sorry for her, might be willing to take care of her, but he's not. Let's keep reading. It says, Judah then said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, "Live as a widow in your father's household until my son Shelah grows up," for he thought he may die too, just like his brothers. So Tamar went to live in her father's household. Essentially, what Judah is doing at best is fearing for the safety of his third son, but more likely and at worst, blaming Tamar for what has happened. I mean, why else would two young sons die if not for what this woman is doing? I mean, he's got to be thinking there's either a curse on my family, maybe for what I did to Joseph, or something's up with her. I mean, as I was studying this week, it said women who are prone to become widows were suspected of witchcraft, which we shake our heads and kind of go, ooh. But we live in that world today too, don't we? I mean, have we seen a woman that's been married a few times and husbands have died? I mean, they have true crime podcasts about that, don't they, Amy? Amen. I mean, we even have a name for it, don't we? What's that woman called? A black widow, right? I mean, that's what we do and say. And so the fact that he sends her back to her father's house reveals his true intention for her. You can't have my third son. I don't trust you with him. I've lost two already. So off to dad's house she goes. And as I said earlier, what's interesting is he could have released her to be able to marry someone else, but he doesn't. She can't remarry. She's left in this state of limbo. And this could indicate for us that, you know what he does? He really does blame her for the death of his two sons. But then the story continues to unfold. Look at verse 12. It says, after a long time, and we don't know how long, but after a long time, Judah's wife, the daughter of Shua, died. So Judah had recovered from his grief. He went up to Timnah to the men who were shearing the sheep, and his friend Hira went with him. When Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is on his way to Timnah to shear the sheep," she took off her widow's clothes. She covered herself with a veil to disguise herself and then sat down at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she thought that though Shelah had grown up, she'd not been given to him as a wife. You see what's happening here? The son's old enough, but dad's not following through. So she's taking matter into her own hands. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she covered her face. Not realizing that she was his daughter-in-law, he went over to her by the roadside and said, "Come now, let me sleep with you." Remember I said this wasn't a PG story, right? "And what will you give me to sleep with you?" she asked. "I'll send you a young goat from my flock," he said. "Will you give me something as a pledge until you send it?" she asked. He said, "What pledge should I give you?" "Your seal and its cord and the staff in your hand," she answered. So he gave them to her. He slept with her, and she became pregnant by him. After she left, she took off her veil and put on her widow's clothes again. Now, isn't this where things get kind of interesting? Tamar, essentially forgotten about in her parents' house, Shelah is of marrying age, but her phone wasn't ringing, saying, "Come back and marry him." And she knows this, so she devises a plan. She knows this man well enough to know how to appeal to him. And let's be honest, we're a bit uncomfortable with this plan, aren't we? I mean, you should be. She uses his sexual urges against him. She puts on a veil, which is what a prostitute would have done, but also so she won't be recognized, so that she can go in and sleep with her father-in-law in hopes of getting pregnant to have the heir that she was promised. And what seems to be so distasteful to us was a woman simply trying to retain some dignity and security. But let's not sugarcoat this either. This is a situation for Tamar that could have gone either way. Do you understand that? That what she's doing will either redeem her or condemn her to death. This is both sides. And based on Judah's actions previously, what do you think is more likely? But she was incredibly wise in what she did. And this man, in the company of other men in the Bible who do less than wise things, decides to leave behind for this woman his driver's license, his keys, and his wallet. I mean, that's essentially what he does. I mean, let's just be honest. Guys, he's an idiot, just like most of us. It's fine. So let's wrap this up. What's going to happen here? Well, Judah does stay true to his word. After all, he wants his keys, his wallet, and his driver's license back. So he sends his friend back to find this woman, and he's got a goat with him to get his things. But this woman is nowhere to be found. In fact, they thought Tamar was a temple prostitute, but then as his friend is like inquiring, he's like, where's that temple prostitute that was out by the road? And the people are like, there ain't no temple prostitute here. What are you talking about? His friend tells Judah, I can't find her anywhere. And Judah's finally like, fine, let's just let it go. She can keep what she's got, because if we keep looking, I'm going to be a laughing stock, and I don't want to be a laughing stock. Again, any guy here doubt this is the conversation going on between these men? Not at all. I mean, they're trying to cover it up now. Let's do anything to keep us from losing face here. And then we come to the end of the story. Verse 24 says this. About 3 months later, Judah was told, your daughter-in-law Tamar is guilty of prostitution, and as a result, she is now pregnant. Judah said, bring her out, and we're going to burn her to death. As she was being brought out, she sent a message to her father-in-law. Look at this. This woman is shrewd and wise. She sent a message to Judah, and she says, I'm pregnant by the man who owns these. And she added, see if you recognize whose seal and cord and staff these are. You got to love this, right? I mean, this is a moment. This is genius right here. She knew what she was doing. Verse 26 says, Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her my son Shelah. And he did not sleep with her again. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her room. As she was giving birth, one of them put out his hand, so the midwife took a scarlet thread and tied it to his wrist and said, this one came out first. But when he drew back his hand, his brother came out, and she said, this is how you have broken out. So he was named Perez. We've seen that name before. And then his brother, who had the scarlet thread on his wrist, came out, and he was named Zerah. And we've seen that name before. What a twist, right? I mean, it's good stuff. This is nice, interesting reading here. Judah goes from burner at the stake to saying, wow, she is more righteous than me. And who would have guessed that this man, who basically up to this point has done almost everything wrong, would be willing to say, I am wrong. And yet he is. And while we may not want to give Judah much credit, we do have to acknowledge that he at least did the right thing here. And what is messy and complicated for us gets even more so by the fact that Tamar is pregnant, she has two sons, and continues the family line, which will run through King David all the way to Jesus. I mean, if this was on the Who Do You Think You Are show, we'd be paying big money for this story to not be told, wouldn't we? And yet Matthew, for some reason, puts it right there to remind us about what is in Jesus's lineage. So what do we do with this story? What are we to make of this? This is such a fascinating story, isn't it? I got a few thoughts on how we kind of can read this. And the first thing is this. We need to remember that not everything in the Bible is prescriptive. I shouldn't have to say this, but sometimes we get overload on literalness of everything in the Bible. This is not a prescriptive story. We are not told this to go out and repeat or live this in any way. I hear often people advocating for biblical marriage. I would just say not this one. Okay? If you got to pick one, this is not the one to pick. Okay? This is not prescriptive. Number two, what I would say is when I look at Judah, I see a man who is blind to reality. He's willing to lay the blame on someone who may be innocent, but also might be making decisions from his wounds. Let me explain. Here's a man, and his two sons are obviously not good guys. I mean, the Bible describes them as evil. And yet the way Judah decides to deal with Tamar indicates he's most likely blaming her, not the evil ones, for what has happened. As I read that, and I thought, you know, she is forced to pay the price for the actions of evil men because he is unable or unwilling to see the truth of the situation. I wonder sometimes, are we also as blind in our own lives? Do we fall into the same trap? In our desire to justify ourselves, to justify a position we hold, we become blind to the evil and injustices happening around us, sometimes willing to ignore it, but even at times willing to call evil good. I think Judah did that. And I think it's interesting because just like Judah, we think we can get away with it. Because I think he thought, let me get rid of this woman. She's clearly a witch. I mean, she has to be, right? We'll just put her off in the corner at her dad's house. Now, we don't really care about her. We just don't want to be around her. And I'm going to protect what I have. The blindness to the reality, I think, causes us to make really, really bad decisions and to align ourselves with really, really bad people and positions. This is a story of a reminder that, as the Bible says, our sins will find us out eventually. When we stand for injustice, that will come out eventually, just like it did with Judah. I wonder how blind we are. Are we blind like Judah? Is this story a reminder to have our eyes opened and be willing to take that hard, honest look? I mean, Amy was leading us through this morning a moment of confession. There's nothing more uncomfortable than having to acknowledge your own stuff. But how clean can the house get if we move the couch and we don't pick up the toys and the dog treats? How clean can our lives get if we don't acknowledge the things that are holding us back? And I'll tell you, we can be pretty self-deceptive sometimes. And this story is a reminder to be open to what we may not be able to see, but maybe more importantly, be open to when God is confronting us on those things like Judah had confronted with the whole issue of Tamar. Third, while it may be uncomfortable for us to think about what she did, I do think we have to look at Tamar. She's a hero here, a heroine, isn't she? She demonstrates strength and persistence and wisdom and courage. I mean, this woman had no power at all. And yet what she did ensured the continuation of the line of Judah, which Jesus is going to come from. That's amazing. I mean, as one commentator wrote, it said, Tamar, through her determination to have children, secured for Judah the honor of fathering both David and the Savior of the world. Yeah. Wow. It's not because Judah, it's because Tamar was willing to put her own life on the line to get the right thing done, to seek justice. And as I thought about Tamar, I thought about how she was truly powerless in so many ways. But then there were areas where she wasn't. And even though she had no status or authority, she still had agency. Everything was stacked against her. She was dependent upon Judah for everything. And she was denied justice. And yet she found a way. She used what she did have to seek justice. And in the end, she was called more righteous than Judah. That's his words. And she becomes the way God is going to bring redemption to the world. In spite of how some may have tried to silence her and push her into obscurity. And you know what the Bible does? The Bible doesn't push her into obscurity. The Bible affirms her. So there you go. There's your first Christmas story. What do you think? Merry, Merry Christmas. There's significance to this story. It was inspired by the Holy Spirit to be part of our Bibles. And while it may seem insignificant, I actually did the math. It says this story only makes up about 0.1% of our Bible. It is a reminder to us, and we're going to see this through the entire series, that God works through our mess. We need to be reminded of that. We need to be reminded that the lineage of Jesus includes messiness, but it also includes ethnic diversity. She, Tamar, was a Canaanite, a Gentile. And as we'll get through more, it's going to include offspring, you know, as we see this one here, that were conceived out of wedlock. Wow! That's not something we put right up on the family tree often. Joyce Baldwin, a commentator, said this. It said, in the providence of God, the lineage of Judah fulfilled God's purposes, which had of necessity to bear with human sinfulness in order to redeem it. That God saves by grace and not by merit needs to be unmistakable so that all may read and understand. That's good, isn't it? And when we get to the New Testament, not only do we see Tamar's name mentioned in his genealogy, you know what you also see? Jesus, one of the names that he carries is the Lion of Judah. It really should be the Lion of Tamar, to be honest. I mean, if we're really, you know, but he's the Lion of Judah. You see it there in Revelation chapter 5. And we're reminded that if God can work through the mess of Tamar and Judah's story and bring the Messiah and redemption to the world, is there anything in your life that he cannot redeem, including you? Worship team, go ahead and come back. I just want you to sit with that question for just a moment. If God can work through the mess of Tamar and Judah's story, and if he can bring the Messiah and the redemption of the world through their mess, is there anything in your life he cannot redeem, including you? Just think on that for just a moment.